Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Got a jam-packed program today. So much to talk about, including college basketball as UCLA and USC together in the Elite Eight of March Madness men's college basketball. The first time the same season that they've been there in the Elite Eight, and they have huge tasks ahead of them if they're going to reach the Final Four, as UCLA will be taking on Michigan, a number one regional seed and a powerhouse this season. And for USC, it's an even tougher challenge. Gonzaga from Spokane, Washington, the overall number one seed and undefeated this season. They have just made it look like it's the rest of the tournament versus Gonzaga in their games so far this season. But we begin with the very latest on COVID-19. And joining us, always a pleasure to have Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist from Pasadena's Huntington Memorial Hospital with us. Dr. Schreiner, so good to have you back with us.
Nice to be back with you, Larry.
So let's talk first of all about what you're seeing at Huntington. You still have some COVID patients you're treating there?
We do. The numbers are down, which is terrific. It's a little moment of relaxation for some of the nurses and recuperation and so forth. There's a little bit of an ominous silence, which is sort of bothering most of us in infectious disease right now in California, is that watching what's happening in Europe and on the East Coast is disturbing. And so I think we're really trying to be very, very careful in terms of getting ready for another surge, hopefully not on the level that we saw in the wintertime, but I think it's possible, so we need to be ready.
Well, and one advantage I would think is this time is that so many seniors and so many people with underlying conditions have now been vaccinated, the people most apt to be hospitalized. So even if we do have a surge in cases, it would seem likely, wouldn't it, that most of those would be among younger people?
It's likely. There are certainly seniors who don't respond to the vaccine, or there are individuals that don't respond to the vaccine. It doesn't have to be just a senior. So there's that piece of things. The variant issue is of great concern in terms of the ability of the variants, some of the variants, to escape the vaccine. Most of the variants right now appear to be at least good enough, covered good enough by the vaccines. But the problem is when you have populations, even in young people who aren't going to be hospitalized, where the virus is replicating and circulating very quickly, the opportunity for it to develop a mutation that will entirely escape the vaccines is much higher. And that's really, I think, what's driving most of the concern for the infectious disease docs around the country, is that those populations of unchecked viral replication, where we could possibly see a variant that emerges that entirely avoids the vaccine.
Well, and so as terrible as that is to contemplate, let's take a moment on that. If a variant arises that is able to fend off the current vaccines, would that put us back to square one, or is it likely that in a quick period of time, the vaccine manufacturers would be able to adapt to come up with something to deal with the variant?
Well, the first part is, I hope, and it does appear to be maybe the case, at least some of the stuff we've done in the laboratory, that the vaccines, though they may be imperfect, would certainly prevent severe disease and death. And so that, even if they weren't quite as active, that type of activity would still probably be present. The second piece is that both Pfizer and Moderna are working on a sort of new variant type vaccines, and it might require perhaps a booster with the current vaccines, another booster to really ramp up the immune system again, or a booster with a variant, a selective vaccine to protect us if that happens. And we certainly hope that won't happen, but that's why everyone's concerned about, you know, getting as many people vaccinated as fast as possible to get on top of the variants and keep them from continuing to to emerge.
Dr. Schreiner, California has one of the very lowest rates of COVID-19 in the country right now. Is that due, at least in part, do you think, to how much COVID-19 that we had around just a few weeks ago and so many people who got sick that now we have a higher percentage of people who have some degree of immunity?
It could be, Larry, and we hope that's the case. But I fear, if you remember exactly this time last year, we were kind of commenting on how California didn't have as much disease as New York. New York was getting just really slammed last year at this time. It was sort of the beginning of their first really big surge. And there were all kinds of theories about, well, California people are spread out more, they're not so compacted and everything. And then we got hit with our first big surge. And so I hope that's the case, that there's so much endemic disease and natural immunity right now in the communities, especially in Southern California, that will protect us a little bit from the situation. Plus, you know, we're really getting lots of people vaccinated, which is just terrific. That's a great accomplishment. We just need to keep pressing on with that. But I hope that's the case. Time will tell. It's going to be the next 2 to 4 weeks that will really be, especially after the Easter holiday, Passover, and then, of course, Memorial Day, that we'll see whether that's true.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, and I welcome your questions for Dr. Schreiner. I know she does, too. 866-893-KPCC. You can tweet at AirTalk, post on the AirTalk Facebook page, or post on the AirTalk page itself at kpecc.org. 866-893-5722. Of course, day after tomorrow, we have eligibility for vaccination statewide, 50 and up, without any sort of health considerations having to be taken into account. And then just 2 weeks after that, every Californian 16 and older will be vaccine eligible. But getting an appointment is going to be a tremendous task, and a lot of that will be persistence and the luck of the draw, so to speak. Dr. Schreiner, what's your sense of the mismatch in the next couple of weeks between the number of people eligible and likely to pursue appointments versus the doses of vaccine available for appointments to be made?
Well, I know that the feds are really trying to get as much vaccine out as possible, and so we hope that that there will be a plenty of supply. It does appear to be the case. It may take a little bit of time to sort of get that all organized. The MyTurn system is up and running now, not without its problems, but it is the main registration site for the big vaccine sites. More pharmacies are having access to the vaccine and places like that to be vaccinated. So perseverance is the name of the game here. We really want people to get vaccinated. If you just keep pressing the refresh button or you just keep looking, you're likely to get the shot. And now that we've opened it up really to such a wide group of people, we're hoping that everybody will take the opportunity to do that. We're going to reach a point where we're beginning to see some slowdown, I would think, just because we've got so many people vaccinated. And then we have, you know, the folks that really are hesitant to get the vaccine, and we'll have to sort of see where that population goes once we see how things pan out with the pandemic here.
David in Pasadena asks if we have some news on how long the vaccinations provide protection. He's probably thinking about the people in the clinical trial who continue to be monitored. Are they still showing antibody response, to your knowledge, Dr. Schreiner?
Yes, they are, and that's good news. That's really why we recommend that even if you've had the natural infection, that you go ahead and proceed and get vaccinated, because the vaccine seems to be better immunity and longer lasting immunity. It does. Right now, they have not put out any information that there seems to be a fall off in the level of neutralizing antibodies. And in the studies, they're also evaluating cellular response, which is a much harder test to do, but it does appear to be continue to be robust.
Teresa up in Trinity County, where she's listening, asks if diphenhydramine, otherwise known as Benadryl, is taken around the time of the Moderna booster. Would that decrease the possibility of a reaction?
It might, and just sort of for the record, it won't diminish your immune response. So if you are someone that has severe allergies, and you're a little bit concerned about the vaccine, taking a Benadryl before you get the vaccine is reasonable. The most of the side effects with these vaccines are very minimal, and thankfully, although we've had a few cases of anaphylaxis, it's pretty rare. The vaccine sites will monitor people very closely, and they will provide Benadryl if you start having a kind of tightness or itching in your throat or something. That happens sometimes in our vaccine center, so we provide them with medications right then, and it takes care of it. But it won't hurt your response, and if it gives you a little peace of mind, that's fine.
My mother is volunteering at the VA, helping them with their vaccinations for the veterans in the community. And she said the nurses there are recommending that those getting the shots drink plenty of water, that they say that helps with the side effects from the vaccines. I had not heard that before, but is there any evidence for that?
Well, you know, we certainly, when people are not, when they're kind of volume depleted, they're a little bit more prone to having what we call a vasovagal event, which we have with some regularity in our vaccine clinic. There's a lot of anxiety with getting this shot, I think, and a lot of kind of anxiety around where we are with the pandemic. So we have a lot of emotional responses in our clinic, and kudos to your mom for doing that, by the way, Larry. That's just a great thing to do. So being well hydrated is important in terms of when you're having a little stressor like a vaccine, then it's a good idea. If you're volume depleted, if you're dehydrated, you're a little more prone to getting kind of dizzy or even having a fainting episode.
We're at 866-893-KPCC, the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Maurice in Hollywood says, I heard about a variant in Brazil that has vaccine resistance. Is that true? And is there currently a travel ban in place from Brazil? I certainly don't know about any travel ban from Brazil. We can look that up, though, and see if that's the case. What do we know about the variant from Brazil, Dr. Schreiner?
So that's the P1 variant, and I share Maurice's concern. That is the really nasty player. Manaus is a city in northern Brazil, and they have just been inundated with COVID. Part of Brazil's problem is they've had a federal government that's been kind of in denial about it and have foregone some fairly simple mitigation measures that could have prevented that from happening. But this is indeed a much more serious variant, and it in fact does seem to escape the current vaccines. There have been a couple cases of recognition of P1 in the United States. It's not very common. It may still be kind of outfoxed by the now famous B117, which is the UK variant that's the most infectious and sort of the most efficient replicator, and so that one kind of has certainly become, or is becoming, and probably has become the dominant one. But this really speaks to the need for doing genomic testing too, which we haven't done too much in the United States. We're now ramping that up quite a bit all over the country to keep our sort of finger on the pulse of what's emerging with viruses. P1 is scary, and let's hope it doesn't get into the country.
Stephen in Fullerton, you're on Air Talk with Huntington Hospital's Dr. Kimberly Schreiner.
Hi there. My wife and two daughters made it for the first shot, and they went for the second shot. But one of my daughters missed that appointment due to her car troubles. So my question is there a time frame, or should she be content with the efficacy rate of just having one of the two doses?
Stephen, do you know how long it's been since she got the first shot?
4 weeks ago.
4 weeks ago. Okay. Dr. Schreiner?
And this was the Moderna or Pfizer?
Yeah, I can't remember which one. I'm sorry.
It doesn't really matter, Stephen. Just tell her to get the shot when her car is working. The second booster shot is really to kind of lock in the immunity, and the timing of that we think is probably a little more flexible than the studies were set. The studies were set up to be done very precisely. But in Europe and in Britain, they've actually spread that distance out to about 12 weeks with the Pfizer vaccine, which they've been using over there. So no worries. She does have quite a bit of immunity after the first shot, but I would probably go ahead and recommend that she get the second one, but she can do that in the next couple of weeks. Not a problem.
All right, Stephen, thank you so much. By the way, on travel from Brazil, we were not able to find any ban on that at all. There is from the U.S. Secretary of State's office a do not travel to Brazil due to COVID-19 advisory. It's level 4. Exercise increased caution in Brazil as well. and the travelers to Brazil may experience border closures, airport closures, travel prohibitions, stay-at-home orders, business closures, and other emergency conditions within Brazil due to COVID-19. But we were not able to find anything about the reverse of that, any stoppage of travel from Brazil to the United States. I do think that, you know, again, everybody who's coming in is still asked to quarantine, aren't they, if they're traveling from overseas?
Yes, they are, yeah. And that would probably raise a few eyebrows if you said, I just flew in from Manaus. I mean, anybody who's at the airport who knows anything about what's going on down there, I think would be a little concerned. So, yes, there is a 14-day quarantine for international flights, I believe. You know, how well that's enforced is a little bit unclear. Most international carriers require you to have a COVID test to get on the airplane. But, of course, that can be sometimes you can get a negative test just before you're getting sick and still be infectious. So that's not a perfect thing, but it is required by many, many international carriers.
While we're on the topic of air travel, John in Santa Monica says, I'm about to fly to Australia for work. What suggestions does Dr. Schreiner have for precautions on the long plane flight? Is it okay to eat on the flight? I've been fully vaccinated, John says.
Well, the vaccine will help you. You know, I was going to say hold your breath, but that's kind of a long flight. So a good mask is a good idea to mask, especially the most dangerous time is maybe not so much on the aircraft as it is getting onto the airplane and in the airports and on other transit transportation. So certainly a high-quality mask, very least a KN95 or double mask. If you can get your hands on an N95, they're uncomfortable, but I would wear that as much as you can. You can eat on the flight since you've been vaccinated that, you know, short period of time when you take your mask off. Obviously, if your seatmate is coughing up a storm, then maybe you don't do that. But I think, you know, common sense and the fact that you're vaccinated and armed with a good mask and trying to keep your distance as much as you can, wash your hands, maybe wipe down the seat with some alcohol swabs or something before you sit down. Those are all good things to decrease the risk. But the risk is smallish because of the presence of the vaccine.
We'll continue with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital, infectious disease specialist. For more than a year now, she's been part of the KPCC family, answering your questions and taking the most complex science around the coronavirus and making it understandable for all of us. I've learned so much from her during the course of her weekly visits. And I mean, that is the positive that's come out of this terrible pandemic is we've had the opportunity to hear from so many of our leading people in the world of medical science. We'll be back with more with Dr. Schreiner in just 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we preview the very big college basketball games between the UCLA and USC men's team, separate games. UCLA playing Michigan, USC taking on the tournament's top seed, undefeated this season, Gonzaga. Both games on this evening. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital with us. Dr. Schreiner, we've heard anecdotally about people who 2 to 3 days after they've received their vaccination having an adverse reaction. This is a little different to what we've been hearing earlier on of people maybe the next day for a day or two having, particularly to the Moderna second vaccination, some side effects. What do we know about ones happening a few days later?
Well, you know, the immune system is enormously complex, Larry, and so there's sort of an immediate type of response that's mitigated by different kinds of little chemicals and some special cells, and then there's a little bit more of a delayed hypersensitivity reaction and activation of the immune system. So that's pretty typical. You'll hear a lot of people say, you know, I felt fine for the first couple of days except for a sore arm, but then I felt really fatigued for about a week. I personally experienced that as well, although it's hard for me to tell whether that was just from working so much.
You were probably tired for other reasons, too.
Yeah. So, but that's normal. That just means your immune system is doing what it's supposed to do. The second vaccine is more likely to do that because it's already seen the spike protein, and now you're sort of representing it, and that's a very normal response. Sometimes that lasts a little longer, a week maybe, sometimes 10 days. But it's all very normal, and it will go away, and it'll provide you with some great coverage if you encounter the real beast.
Jay in Fontana said, I just took my first dose of Pfizer. I had a bit of a bad reaction, body ache, severe headache that led me to be nauseous. They said that I couldn't take Excedrin. I wanted to know if there's anything I could take to help me deal with side effects for my second dose upcoming.
So, you know, this is sort of a problem we still haven't quite figured out, is giving anti-inflammatories prior to the vaccine, does that sort of dampen the immune response a little bit? There's some anecdotal data to suggest that, perhaps a little bit of laboratory data, but it's not clear. So we recommend you try to avoid those. If you have to, if you're on corticosteroids or you're taking medications for some other reason that's, you know, you need to take for your arthritis or whatever, then it's fine. Just go ahead and do it. I think Tylenol is always a good go-to medication for before and after the vaccine. If you can avoid taking it just before your second vaccine, let your immune system rip a little bit. That's a good idea. Then, if you have some problems, you can take the Tylenol. Don't take more than 3 grams a day, but you can take it about every six to eight hours, if that helps a little bit with some of the post-vaccine problems.
And there's no problem taking it with rather quickly after the second vaccination? It doesn't impede effectiveness?
No, I wouldn't do it sort of prophylactically. But again, that data is very unclear. And there's probably lots of people that are doing it, you know, taking medications, and they're having a perfectly normal immune response. So it's that one or two pills is not going to make that much difference.
Walker in West Hollywood says, I've been isolating for the past year. I don't have transportation. My cousin and his wife, who've been vaccinated, have offered to take me to get the vaccine. I'm wondering if that's safe if we all wear masks.
Yes, it is. And get vaccinated.
All right, very good. Yeah, my recollection is that the CDC recommendations is that if you've got a group where everybody is fully vaccinated, they've gone 2 weeks past the second vaccine, that it is safe for them to be with someone, one household that is unvaccinated, provided no one within that household is at high risk. And does that still hold true, Dr. Schreiner, for recommendation?
It does, but I think for Walker's case, I would still encourage everybody to wear masks. The CDC sort of made that proviso that if you went into a household where there was a non-high-risk person, you could go maskless as long as the other people were all vaccinated. And that makes sense, but it makes me a little nervous because it's hard for people to sort of know who's at risk and who's not. And so I think for someone who's been so diligent about keeping themselves protected for a year, you sort of don't want to blow it on the way to the vaccine place. So wear a mask, and certainly wear a mask while you're getting in your vaccine venue there, because there are people that obviously are not vaccinated. So,
Doreen in West L.A. says, I went to see an ophthalmologist. One of the people working there said she wasn't going to get the vaccine. Why aren't doctors and medical personnel required to be vaccinated? Well, Doreen, the important thing to keep in mind is that the vaccines have only been approved for emergency use authorization, and it's probably a bit dicey to require something that's only authorized in that sort of provisional manner to make it a requirement. Dr. Schreiner, what do you think?
Well, that's exactly, from the legal standpoint, Larry, you're absolutely right, and that's exactly why we can't enforce it. It's tricky to make vaccination mandatory. You know, there's lots of people that, for reasons that are quite personal, you know, don't want to do it. It is, you know, we encourage everyone to get vaccinated. It is safe. It is effective. COVID-19 is a terrible, terrible disease. And so, especially healthcare workers who are exposed to it, you know, we really want them vaccinated for themselves, to protect themselves and their families and their colleagues and their patients. So, but if they choose not to, at this point, we can't force it. And, you know, that's just something that's the way it is.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Roy in Los Angeles says there are recommendations that NSAIDs like ibuprofen and acetaminophen be avoided at the time of vaccination. Is the same true for medical cannabis, CBD plus THC? I know many other people in my age group, 45 and up, that also use medical cannabis.
I don't know if there's any data on that. I think that, you know, the cannabinoids do have some effect on the immune system. Whether it enhances or suppresses an immune response, we don't know. From a common sense standpoint, I would try to keep yourself as sort of contaminant-free as possible, whether that's a medication or a cannabinoid or or whatever, alcohol. You know, I think it's a good idea to kind of have your immune system in its natural state as much as possible when you get the vaccine, so that ensures a good response.
Stephen Northridge says he gets in his jacuzzi every night in 104-degree water. Does that make the vaccine less effective?
No.
All right. Steve, go to it. Keep those muscles loosened up. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. A question we've gotten frequently, but we'll take it again. Lynn in Huntington Beach wondering why we don't have the dosage of the vaccines based on the weight of the individual. People wonder, well, wouldn't that mean that it would go further if you were only giving half doses to people that were smaller? Dr. Schreiner, why is it one size fits all?
Well, those studies were done with the preliminary work with both Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. They did try different dosages, and they were more concerned with the immune response than the body habitus. And so because these are stimulating your immune system, you know, you just need a little teeny bit of the information, especially with the mRNA vaccines, to stimulate the immune system. It doesn't have too much to do with body mass, and that's why the dosage doesn't change. I do think they are adjusting the dosage, I believe, and I don't have exact data on this. I think they've changed the dosage a little bit for children, for very young children, as they're beginning to do those trials now. But for the most part, it's sort of one shot fits all, literally, because what you're doing is just creating this little situation where your immune system is activated by a small bit of material, and that doesn't depend on your body size.
We have D. Rowe tweeting at AirTalk. Is there any evidence to support the claim that if you had COVID, it's not necessary to get the second dose of the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine? Also, do people who had COVID feel stronger side effects after the first shot?
So the answer to the second question is yes. People who've had the real disease often have a more dramatic response even after they get their first shot, because their immune system knows what it's seeing. The reason we recommend that you get vaccinated after natural infection is because the vaccine has got better immunity. There's sort of some thought now that maybe those people don't need to have the two vaccines, that they can get the one. The CDC is still just recommending two vaccines, but there's lots of I think there's a lot of us that think that probably just one, since the natural infection sort of served as the first vaccine, if you will, that you'd only need one after that. It's a little murky, but it won't hurt you to get a second vaccine, but you probably are going to have a little bit of a reaction if you've had COVID.
Ed wrote on our AirTalk Facebook page, today is National Doctors Day. Let's recognize their great work. Indeed, I had no idea there was a National Doctors Day, but happy National Doctors Day, Dr. Schreiner.
Thank you very much, Larry.
And we should extend that, I think, to all medical professionals in all different positions throughout the healthcare system. We appreciate you so much, not just today on this formal day, but throughout the year when even more than ever, I think we appreciate the tremendous sacrifices, commitment to professionalism, and all that has come with the care provided during this very challenging year plus. We have Sharon in Redondo Beach with a question for Dr. Schreiner. You're on AirTalk.
Hi, doctor. I got my first shot of Moderna yesterday, and I forgot to not take my baby aspirin that I take every day because I have a prothrombin gene mutation, and I took it today, too. I forgot to. And I'm wondering with the second shot if I should not take the baby aspirin.
No, the baby aspirin, you know, if you're taking that for a different reason, Sharon, for your coagulation system, go ahead and take it. It's not going to interfere with your response to the vaccine, and it's an important part of your regular therapy. So don't not take medications that are important because of the vaccine, but just if you can avoid extra anti-inflammatories, you know, ibuprofen or that sort of thing, then it's a good idea. But take your baby aspirin.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I know there's a lot of research going on about different types of masks. ones that you might be able to see facial expressions better, but don't get so hot as the ones with the plastic windows that are out there now. Have you seen any, Dr. Schreiner, that you think are particularly promising or that show significant advantages over the ones we're currently using?
Well, I'm pleased to see the sort of interest now in mask making and coming up with better, especially for healthcare workers, because we have to wear the masks for long, long periods of time, and obviously have high risk of exposures. And, you know, we have to remember there are plenty of other airborne pathogens, tuberculosis certainly, that are out there. So it's important that we have good, effective masks. There's some very interesting technology that's being developed, some masks that actually have that are virucidal. In other words, the virus encounters the mask and it actually kills the virus. That's an interesting idea. There's masks that improve the aeration so that your glasses don't fog up or you're having trouble breathing without exposing you to more virus. So I think there's a lot of technology that's being developed that's going to be very important, predominantly in the healthcare field, but also making it more comfortable for wearing a mask on a long airplane flight to Australia or something. So I think that's a really good thing. We have to focus on PPE because no matter what pandemic this is, it's important that we be better prepared for the next one. And PPE is always the very most important part of mitigation.
Universal Studios Hollywood just announced it will reopen April 16th. Annual and season pass holders will be able to return the day prior to that. This with L.A. County in the red tier, although if things continue on this positive trend, hopefully we'll be in the orange tier pretty soon. So capacity will still be limited to 15% once it's in the less restrictive orange tier. Then 25% capacity would be allowed. I presume that's what Universal Studios is banking on, that they'll be at that point by mid-April, 25% as their capacity. Dr. Schreiner, you think it's likely that they'll be able to do that?
Well, I know there's so many people that really miss that kind of fun, so I hope that we are able to fulfill that kind of normality thing that we're all looking for by opening up some of those sort of entertainment areas. It makes me a little nervous, I have to say, and those are opportunities for super spreader events. So I think if the theme parks are very vigilant, if they absolutely require mask wearing and are very vigilant about social distancing, then they probably can do it safely. A lot of people are vaccinated. That's a great thing. It'll be a true test of our vaccine robustness, I think. But it is a high-risk thing, and you can imagine going down Splash Mountain with everybody yelling. That could be a super spreader right there. So, I think that we'll just have to see. It's going to be the test.
Paul in Ojai, good to have you with us with Dr. Schreiner.
Hi, my question and statement is that I had a severe reaction with the palsy to the swine flu vaccine a little over 40 years ago. And I was told then never get a flu shot again for the rest of my life. I want this vaccine, but I don't know if it's safe for me to take it. And I don't have a doctor.
Paul, I understand you spent 7 months in the hospital after that swine flu vaccination?
Correct.
Wow. Paul, thank you. Dr. Schreiner?
So that's a consideration, Paul. I would certainly, first of all, I'd encourage you to not only get a primary care physician, but also perhaps have a referral to an immunologist so they can do a little bit of an evaluation. That is a little bit of a high risk. On the other hand, we know that COVID is a very, very dangerous disease. If that was that much of a debilitating event after that vaccine, it might not be a good idea to get one of these vaccines, and you might be one of the people that we have to protect by getting the herd immune. There's obviously a whole group of people that can't get vaccinated for various reasons. But I would encourage you to get a primary care doctor and have them refer you to an immunologist and have that discussion with that physician, because there may be ways around it. This is a different vaccine. This is maybe where mRNA vaccines are actually better because they might be less likely to produce that, but you should have some consultation before you do it.
All right, Paul, we wish you all the best. Dr. Schreiner, thank you as always for joining us. We so appreciate your expertise and your time. I look forward to talking with you next week.
Me too, Larry. Have a good day.
All right, thanks. You too. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Pasadena's Huntington Hospital. Coming up, a big day in local sports. The UCLA and USC men's basketball teams in the Elite Eight of the NCAA's March Madness. Both have very challenging games on their schedule tonight in the effort to make it to March Madness's Final Four next weekend. We'll talk with the beat writers for each of the schools at the LA Times coming up in just 90 seconds on Air Talk.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.